Call the House Committee on Rules to order and let the record show our quorum is present. With that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2414. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2414 as amended, which we amended last work session, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger has moved House Bill 2414 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, the dash ones are the amendments that were adopted, which has the effect of up to three parties. Is that
correct?
Okay. Thank you.
That's correct.
Oh, that's right. And I do need to put on the record that we do have our revenue impact statement and our fiscal impact statement as amended, and they're at the dais. So we do have all that stuff.
And the answer is, sir?
They are minimal.
Okay.
No impact.
No impact.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Nolan.
Did we get clarification on the issue around Lane County's implementation of this bill?
I've been waiting to find out from Representative Edwards, but I have not seen or heard from him. I did see a copy of a ballot that they did get produced that had the multiple ballots on it. The printing was very small, and I'm not sure how happy Representative Edwards was with that. And another clarification, and we could ask, actually have the Secretary of State maybe come up and answer the question about whether people could change who they nominated. Would you like to hear that answer? That was a question that came up. But, yeah, if you would come out for a second, that would be good. And this is a question, committee, that came to me from a couple different people, and they were asking if a party were to nominate you as a candidate, and therefore offer that nomination to you to put on the ballot, and then you decided to not put it on the ballot, could they then turn around and nominate someone else and offer that to them? And so here's the best guess, or the answer we have right now. So,
Chair Roblum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the Secretary of State Elections Division. If you were to be nominated for a party, you have the option of withdrawing your nomination by the 67th day.
Oh, okay.
And then they could fill that nomination.
If there was enough time, they could go ahead and fill it.
That's correct.
Now, could you accept the nomination but not put it on the ballot?
Chair Roblum, members of the committee, I believe the bill specifies that if you accept the nomination, that party's name would appear.
Mr.
Yes, Representative.
I just wanted to clarify. So if I was nominated by, let's say I'm a Green Party person and for some reason the Democrats nominate me and I don't want the Democratic Party to be behind my name. So they have nominated me, but I decline listing their name on the ballot. Can I do both of those things, retain that endorsement and not have their name on the ballot?
Chair Roblum, Representative Gelser, I would have to research that a little further to get that answer for you. I'm not clear how that would work with this bill.
Mr. Pack.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. My understanding of the bill and talking with some of the advocates of the bill, if you are nominated by a party and accept the nomination, you can choose not to have that designation printed on your ballot but still retain the nomination.
Okay. That's what I thought, but I wasn't quite sure of that one. Okay. So you can retain the nomination but not have it on the ballot.
Yeah, the bill does not, Mr. Chair, the bill does not require
okay
the nomination to be printed on the ballot. It's at the candidate's discretion as to whether it would be printed or not.
And in the case of the two major parties, that's an election that took place, and that one can't be changed because you've won that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. You can choose not to accept it, but there's no other way to get it, anybody else to get that nomination. Okay. Mm-hmm. Could the party, if I chose not to accept, say, run as a Democrat, a write-in happens, I get the Republican nomination. If I chose to not accept that, could they then, their committee, local committee, put up another person?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, as a write-in candidate, no. They could not put up another person in that position because you
won that election.
Won the election by write-in vote.
Oh, okay. Other questions? Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same scenario, only say as a Democrat, and I receive the nomination from a minor party, and if I decline that nomination, then while I could still retain that endorsement, can they, by their rules, renominate somebody else?
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, they could fill that nomination depending on when you declined that party. So you declined, if I'm understanding the question correctly, you're declining the minor party status. You don't want that party's name next to your name on the ballot. You're declining that nomination. Depending on when you do that, determines if there's enough time for them to nominate someone else for that party.
Have another convention.
That's correct.
I think I have another person that would like to answer that question. But yes, Representative Nolan, and then we'll hear from...
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think I've heard two different answers, and I want to be really clear.
Right.
Without this bill, I have in the past, although it wasn't the case in 2008, but in prior years, I have been nominated by the party to which I am a member, and I have been nominated by the other major party. But because of current law, my name appeared once, and the only thing that appeared after that name was Democrat. I could have declined that nomination, in which case they would have, and it occurred during the primary through write-in. If I declined the nomination from the Republican Party, they could have then, through their central committee, nominated someone else to put their name on the ballot. So the real question is choosing not to list another party after your name on the ballot equivalent to declining the nomination, or are they separate actions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roland, I believe they are separate actions. The bill as drafted allows minor parties to nominate a candidate. That candidate can accept the nomination and have that additional party designation on the ballot. They can accept the nomination and choose not to have that printed on the ballot, or they can decline the nomination.
So it is up to the individual candidates how they
that's
go about
what
doing
I thought,
it.
But that's
okay,
not.
That's what I had anticipated. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, is there any possibility we could get LC down here to give us an official opinion on that?
I could certainly ask for them.
Good idea.
Sure, we will do that. So we'll stand at ease while we are waiting for that answer. committee meeting again. Thank you for coming down. So the question has to do with whether you can accept the nomination of another party and also tell the clerk you don't want to necessarily put it on the ballot. That's pretty much it, isn't it? Representative Nolan?
As I understand, the question is, are accepting the nomination and choosing to list the secondary party on the ballot separate actions? Or does not listing a second party void your acceptance of the nomination?
Representative Chair Roblin and Representative Nolan, I think for purposes of this statute, they're only talking about what name you would select to go after rather than accepting the nomination. However, I would have to look at some of the other statutes to see if there was some sort of link where I'm not sure if it says somewhere that once you accept a nomination that you automatically
This would be the only bill that would relate to having it put on the ballot. So the others don't talk about it at all. Okay.
Right.
Okay. So does that help?
Fine.
Okay.
I could look into it more.
I think the Deputy Secretary of State answered the question.
Same way. He said the same thing. So
that one could accept the nomination and choose
whether to put
not
the name
to
on.
List that and still hold on to the nomination, but it's just not listed on the ballot. And that might be something, for example, that candidates in Lane County may choose to do if the ballot truncates the words so much that it is not clear.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further discussion? Representative Gelser.
Thank you. Chair, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this bill, and I'm planning to cast a no vote today because I think that it needs more work. I've heard many conflicting messages about it through the course of its development from people who have supported it and kind of shifted in their opinions of that. And because of that, I'm very interested in this idea and look forward to further discussions, and I appreciate the work that has gone into it so far. But I will be casting a no vote today.
Okay. Representative Edwards.
Oh, yeah, we're up. Okay. So I like this concept. I will be voting no, and I've told some of the advocates what my threshold was, and I've said it here in our last meeting. Is it going to be clear in my county, in Lane County, that there's not going to be confusion about what party you are and who's endorsing you, et cetera, et cetera? I don't, on the ballot itself, I do believe that there is a chance for clarity in the voter's pamphlet statement, but that is different. I want clarity throughout the system, not just in the voter's pamphlet. So I like the concept. I want to do this. I hate voting against bills that I like. But in Lane County, I do not yet have the confidence, and I have had my staff talk with elections in Lane County about what they could do. They feel that they could play with that form a little bit more. Hopefully make it a little bit more clear. But until I can see it and understand that, yes, that is clear and that is not going to create confusion at election time, I'm going to have to be a no, as much as it pains me to be a no, because I really do like this concept. And I reserve my right, if I get to change my vote by the time we get to the vote yes on the House floor, if it goes to the House floor, if Lane County Elections is able to show me that with their system, yes, they can answer my my concerns, and I feel comfortable with that, then I will support it on the floor.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
No.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
No.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. And Carrier Representative Buckley would like to carry. With that, we'll close our hearing on House Bill 2414. That's a truly bipartisan vote.
Can I carry it, Mr. Chair?
That's true, I know.
We're going to open a hearing on
2620.
And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, HB 2620 requires the governor to convene a constitutional convention in 2011 to draft a new state constitution. It establishes delegate qualifications, the number of delegates, and the manner of election. The bill creates a constitutional commission to make recommendations to and serve as a resource for the convention. It requires the chairperson of the convention to certify a proposed constitution to the Secretary of State by August 26, 2001, and requires the Secretary of State to submit a proposed constitution to the people at a special election to be held on November 8, 2011. The State Constitution of Oregon was adopted in 1857 by a vote of more than 2-1. Unlike the relatively short U.S. Constitution, but similar to many states' constitutions, it is a lengthy document and deals with many more detailed matters than is the case with U.S. Constitution. Most of its original provisions, some 172 of 185 sections, were copied from other constitutions. The state constitution was not amended until 1902, when the voters approved an amendment establishing the initiative and referendum process for approving both statutory measures and subsequent constitutional amendments. This made changing the Constitution easier. Since 1902, the Oregon Constitution has been amended more than 100 times, and its length has increased. By contrast, the U.S. Constitution has only been formally amended 27 times since it was adopted more than 200 years ago, the most recent amendment being adopted in 1992. Proponents of SB 2620 assert that the present Constitution is outdated and has been changed in an incremental, piecemeal fashion. Proponents further assert that a constitutional convention is the most appropriate way to change, update, and modernize the state constitution for the 21st century. Concern has been expressed about the cost of conducting a constitutional convention and adopting a new constitution. At this point, we do not, however, have a fiscal impact statement.
Okay. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Chuck Riley. I'm state representative for Hillsborough, Corneas, and Forest Grove. And I've put this bill in with the hope that we would be able to do something about our, as he has said, our outdated constitutions, one that has not been changed since 2 years before we became a state. There are many states that have constitutional conventions, have had multiple constitutional conventions. Illinois, for instance, is in their constitution required to put before the people every 20 years whether or not they want a new constitutional convention. They put that on the ballot every 20 years to ask the people, are you ready for a new one? We don't. We have continued to change ours in minute and magnitude ways that have, in my opinion, weakened our Constitution. We have put things in there which many people think should be statute. Are they not constitutional issues? And it's become very difficult and burdensome to just read the document. It's time for change. And I think that this is one method of doing it. There are other ways to do the same thing. One other way, which you may hear from some people who have tried this before, is to simply call a committee together and write a new constitution and send it out. That's legal now. It has been since sometime in the 50s, I believe. That was passed the first time people thought this was a problem. The legislature passed a law which said we can just write a new constitution, put it out to the people for ratification. We don't have to have a constitutional convention. My bill asks for a constitutional convention because I believe that that's really the more correct way to do it, as opposed to the way which might actually get done. But I would like to see one or the other ways come about. So happy to answer any questions.
Representative Girard.
Representative Riley, has the Supreme Court issued any kind of an opinion on this from the standpoint of they have to deal with the Constitution as it exists and do all the interpretation of the Constitution that your bill refers to? Have they issued any kind of position on this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, not to my knowledge. This would not change anything in the Supreme Court's duties. If we have a constitution, they follow it and make sure that we follow it. It would simply be a new constitution. They would do the same thing they always have.
Representative Gregg, follow up.
Representative, what makes you feel confident that you could find such people that would be capable of doing this task?
Chair Roblin, Representative Gregg, I wouldn't be doing it. The people of Oregon would be doing it. In the bill that I propose, there would be an election of delegates. So the people of Oregon would be deciding who would be doing this, not me.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward with this because I am very sensitive, as you are, to all the add-ons to our Constitution. I worry, though, that in today's climate, you have not got any date of closure here. You have a date to start, but not a date to end. Can you envision that this would go on for years?
I can envision it, but I don't believe it would. And if it would make you feel better, I'd be happy to put an end date on it. I believe that it would take a year to 18 months to do this. I believe that that's the length of time would be required to actually do what's necessary to create a new constitution and get it enacted.
I'm reading the bill, and you don't really, you talk about the election of delegates, mm-hmm. but not about, shall we say, staffing. I mean, it seems to me it would be an army of lawyers, and that's another decision point of who, do you have thoughts on that?
I do, and excuse me, I forgot last time, Chair Roblin, Representative Berger. I do have thoughts on that, and I think that you're somewhat correct. I believe that there'd be a lot of people trying to sway these delegates. There would be a lot of people who want access to them, and they would need a lot of legal scholars, constitutional scholars, to help them to wade their way through this. It's not an easy thing to do. I wouldn't presume to say that it's an easy thing to do. I would hope that the people who were elected, who ran for delegates to do this, and who are elected to be delegates to do this, would be people who would be up to it. There's no guarantee of that, but there was never a guarantee in the first place. The first constitution that we did had no such guarantee, and this doesn't either.
Other questions? I see none. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
I was wasn't a question. It just seems to me that there was someone watching over the first Constitution that we did, though. Like the Congress of the United States, that our Constitution had to meet some tests that they had before we became statewide or state eligible, sort of thing. So there's a big daddy out there looking over our shoulder. In this case, I wouldn't necessarily see that as a possibility. I don't know that that would make that much difference. I don't know that the Congress now would be any wiser than the Congress of 150 years ago would have been, but...
Let me just respond, Chair Roblin, Representative Jensen. I understand what you're saying, and that's why in my particular bill there is a oversight. The Constitution would have to come back and be approved by this body, by the legislature, and then be ratified by the people of the state. So there is... Big Brother to look over it, us and then the people being the biggest of the Big Brothers.
Thank you very much. Next we have Jan Coleman and Norman Williams. They would like to come up and take a seat. We'll let Jan go first and then... Thank you both for being here. Make sure you announce yourself first.
Okay. Representative Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. my testimony is actually fairly short. You're being passed out right now. What we did submit is a fiscal impact statement on the 5th of March, so I'm surprised that you don't have this yet. But... basically, when you're looking at putting the amount of delegates that this bill is proposing on a primary and general election ballot, you're increasing ballot pages dramatically. So, in a nutshell, it increases the cost of the election dramatically. In proportionate... All of the, because this is a nonpartisan race, all of the ballots would be affected. We go to 2 to 3 pages on a ballot. We have extra postage. We have extra paper. The voter pamphlet would increase. Many of the counties at this point insert their voter pamphlets in the state pamphlet. With the size of the pamphlet increase, that may not be possible. So extra postage to both the counties and the state because of that. In other words... you're looking at an increase down in the bottom of 40% to 45% for a primary election and 30% to 35% for a general election. As you can see, it would be a huge impact. Right now, the counties feel that if the state wants to do this, then because the state does not pay in primaries and generals, that they would need to step up and do that.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Berger, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Norman Williams. I'm the director of the Willamette University Center for Law and Government, where I'm also a member of the law faculty there. I come here to make just two very brief points. First, I fully support Representative Riley's view that something needs to be and should be done about updating the Oregon Constitution. Because of the accretion of a number of amendments over time in the past century, the Oregon Constitution is gradually becoming an unwieldy document, both for the people of Oregon to understand as well as for Oregon state government to govern under. The vast majority of states in the Union have updated their constitutions over time, and it's appropriate that Oregon do so sooner rather than later before, like California, it finds itself under an unmanageable state constitution. The second point that I wish to make, however, is that a constitutional convention is only one mechanism that the Oregon Constitution provides for updating. Article 17, Section 1 provides for a constitutional convention, the end result of which is three separate elections that are being put to the Oregon people. One election on Representative Riley's bill, which is whether to call a constitutional convention. A second election at which there will be an election of delegates, and then a third election by the people on whether to accept or reject the proposed constitution. That is a very time-consuming, cumbersome, and costly process. There is another alternative, which is provided for by Article 17, Section 2, which allows the legislature, essentially on its own motion, to put a new constitution before the Oregon voters. The legislature can do that by drafting either the proposed constitution itself or convening a either select committee or commission that would do that work. There is historical precedent for doing this. In 1959, when the state celebrated its centennial as a state, the people of the state of Oregon authorized the legislature to propose a new constitution. Rather than doing it themselves or holding a constitutional convention, the legislature created the Constitutional Revision Commission, which came back with a proposed constitution, which the legislature then debated. Ultimately, that constitution or proposed constitution wasn't sent to the people, though in 1969 this legislature did send a proposed constitution to the people, which was rejected. This other approach, I think, is more time efficient. It would be less costly, and it might provide for the legislature to be more involved in the drafting of the Constitution and therefore be able to educate the Oregon people about the real prices that they are paying for operating under the original 1857 Constitution. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Berger.
What you're proposing, if I understand it, sir, is the mother of all task forces. Am I correct in that?
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Berger. Yes, I am. In fairness, along the lines of the 1959 Constitutional Revision Commission, the process there worked even if the end result wasn't adopted by the people.
Thank you. I just wanted to be sure.
Yeah. Are there questions of these witnesses? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Oh, Representative Jensen.
Thank you for bringing your testimony and your knowledge and wisdom of this. But as a an attorney teaching law, I think if I understood correctly, I'm puzzling at the and thinking about the amount of mass confusion that must take place with a rewrite of the Constitution. You know, ranging from the fact that certain actions on the part of legislatures throughout the eons have been ruled unconstitutional, that under the new Constitution might be constitutional, and vice versa, type of thing. Certain initiatives and referendums or initiatives that have been advanced by the people were declared unconstitutional by the existing court system and the existing Constitution might find the same fate type of thing. And again, the reversal, type of situation there. On to the more mundane things, as I understand them in the law, the case law that develops over 100 years in the state. that has been used to adjudicate cases that might be challenged under a new constitution. It sounds to me like this guaranteed annual employment for attorneys and for the growth of law schools in the country. Is that am I too far off base here? Am I just too cynical, or what?
Yes. Chair Roblin, Representative Jensen, I don't believe that it would be such a boon for either the legal community or law schools. You're undoubtedly right that a new constitution or a constitutional convention would open up a lot of questions that might be settled. There are many unsettled questions under the 1857 Constitution, so I don't think that we're going to marginally be increasing the number of legal disputes under a new constitution than we would under the old, and perhaps might even be able to settle some. The second point, though, that I would make is, once again, by reference to the 1959 Constitutional Revision Commission, which is that commission decided right off the top that it didn't want to tear up the 1857 Constitution and write entirely on a blank slate, that it wanted to take what it had discovered as having worked under the original 1857 Constitution, and in fact that commission decided right off the beginning it would not tinker with nor amend the Bill of Rights under the Oregon Constitution, that Article 1, which enumerates all of the individual rights, would be left intact. And so while a new constitution might indeed bring a new system of governments with it, it wouldn't be so necessarily revolutionary that we would find ourselves back as the pioneers were in 1859, having to answer all of these new legal questions without any guidance or without any pre-existing notion of how those questions should be answered.
Perhaps that is qualified by how creative the new crop of attorneys might be as they search for ways to earn their living in this world. I'm fascinated with the whole idea and the whole concept, and could be brought on board probably if one of the provisions of the bill could be amended to including rewriting the Oregon water law statutes. But that probably is a bigger chore than even a constitutional convention.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Any further questions? Thank you both. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2620. And now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2930. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. HB 2930 requires the Department of Corrections to obtain residency information of all inmates for the purpose of legislative and congressional redistricting. The department is required to determine for each inmate whether the inmate is a resident or non-resident, and for residents to determine the permanent residence of the inmate. It requires the department to provide information to the Legislative Assembly and the Secretary of State by January 1 following the latest federal decennial census. Directs Legislative Assembly or the Secretary of State as applicable to adjust U.S. Census Bureau data to reflect permanent resident status of inmates prior to reapportionment for congressional legislative districts in the state. Requires that resident inmates be considered to reside at their permanent residence for purposes of redistricting and not at their location of the departmental facility in which an inmate is physically located. In terms of background, for census purpose, inmates are regarded as residents of the physical location of the department facility where an inmate is physically located when the census is taken. Proponents of HB 2930 assert that for purposes of redistricting, an inmate should be counted as residing at the inmate's permanent residence as determined by the process established in HB 2930. Proponents assert that the use of unadjusted U.S. Census data in redistricting inappropriately increases the resident population of areas with correctional facilities and reduces the resident population in other areas of the state. Concerns have been expressed about the cost and difficulty of making the determination of residency.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that was a very, very fair description. Colleagues, House Bill 2930 is a bipartisan bill that, in my view, is all about fairness. As you are no doubt aware, both our country and the state of Oregon are preparing to undergo a redistricting process based on the results of the 2010 census. The periodic redrawing of districts helps ensure that legislative districts contains a comparable number of constituents. However, there's a little-known population counting method that, in my view, is a quirk and distorts this process and skews the political representation in nearly every corner of our country. Currently, when drawing legislative maps, the state of Oregon does not count prison inmates as residents of their home communities, but rather as residents of the communities in which they are incarcerated. I just feel that this is an odd way to count the members of legislative districts, since once in prison, these constituents are unable to vote for their representatives. And furthermore, by law, they are required to return to their county of origin. This has the effect of basically giving more political power to people who just happen to live next to a correctional institution, and conversely takes political power away from districts where the inmate may have come from. In 2002, the Oregon Department of Corrections did an analysis of where people were returning to, and the reason this is important for my district is that of the top three zip codes, two of them were in my legislative district, 97211 and 97217. And it just didn't make much sense to me that despite the great representation that they might get in, say, the city of Pendleton by a good representative there, that it made more sense with their family, their kids, all of their significant others, and their relatives, that they should be counted in the place where they're likely to be returned. If you look at the statistics in the Department of Corrections, my understanding of the latest stats is most the average sentence for an inmate is about 3 years, and again, they all are returned to their county in almost all cases, unless there's a compelling reason not to do so. So again, I think this bill is all about fairness. That's why we had, I think, Republicans and Democrats sign on to this in a similar way to the reasons that many Democrats signed on to HJR 36 that provided for bipartisan redistricting of legislative districts and congressional districts, that bill that has been put forward by Representative Bruin, and I'm proud to be a co-sponsor on that bill as well, even though it might be, might end up in an end result that might not help my particular party. I think it's fair. Likewise, I think House Bill 2930 is a fair way to go about counting people for census purposes.
Any questions for this witness? Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, thank you for bringing this bill. I think this is something we need to talk about very seriously, and I think it's timely before we get into the redistricting process that some of these issues get resolved. So thank you.
Yes, that wasn't easy.
Representative Jensen.
I'm deeply sorry, Representative. But I can't thank you for bringing this bill.
we'll do our best to make sure that you're...
I find it, instead of fairness, to be the antithesis in the state of fairness. The overwhelming majority of people incarcerated in the state institutions come out of the populous part of the state, particularly Multnomah County, which probably is that one of those zip codes that you were referring to.
And I've also got a prison very close to that zip code, actually, Columbia River.
And the nature would put these individuals back into their quote-unquote then home areas as far as drawing the boundary lines for state elections and for state offices, particularly the offices that we hold in this chamber and the other chamber. In light of the fact that the area in question is already just overwhelmingly one party represented, and I think we can look at some of the figures on that, you know, without too much trouble. Basically and simply, what I see with it is, in my estimation, and I just ran some crazy loose numbers around as I was after we had talked about it one time. It would be my estimation that it would increase the division between the two parties in this chamber by about one vote, by about one person. This would obviously cause me great concern, and probably this is not necessarily the place that I want to make that statement, since we're not in the I'm representing the minority party here. There's another interesting sort of thing, however, that I find with this. A few days ago, we heard a bill regarding somebody running for public office. And it was brought forth by the good representative who preceded you here, bringing a bill again today. The person's house, the person's property, was split between two two legislative districts. And because the house is in one, even though he considered, and the local elections department considered he lived in the other, decision was that he was not eligible to run in that particular district. I think in a case of somebody running for office, then, Secretary of State's office, and I think probably the law, I don't disagree with the law, I mean the way it's written, has determined that you have to have a residency in that district to run for office. And it seems to me like it's kind of an old saying, but what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If you've got to be a resident of that district to run for office in that district, you ought to have to be a resident of that district, physically a resident of that district, to be counted in how that district's composition is made up. I'd like to be able to thank you for this. As much as it pains me not to, I'm going to have to withhold that thanks and wait for another day, and you have a better idea.
Mr. Chair, is the good representative from the land of loaves and fishes suggesting that inmates be allowed to run for office in his district? But seriously, if I could comment, your point's well taken. I think in a lot of the legislation that we pass, there are often winners and losers, and I think this could be one of those situations. I haven't analyzed how this might affect, but I think if you look at this bill, you look at the bipartisan nature of it, where I talked to some of your colleagues, and even though it might... basically, it struck a chord with them as far as the fairness was concerned. So the department will come up and testify. They've got some concerns about the fiscal, so you might not have to worry too much, Representative Jensen. I think there are also ways that you can narrow that fiscal. My understanding in the LEDS system, which is basically the criminal records system, you can search for addresses, and it's the address of when you committed the crime that they try to keep in there, and then that has some linkages to the Department of Motor Vehicles. So I think I think the Department of Corrections has some very good ideas. If you took some of their ideas, you could limit the fiscal. Obviously, it would still take a little more time than doing nothing on this, as opposed to calling up, a prison and saying, hey, how many people do you have in your prison today? That's pretty easy. But I think, again, this gets to a base issue about fairness, and in my humble opinion, it just simply makes more sense to count people in the area where they're from and the area that they will return to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you.
Thanks.
Next we have Michael Gower and Janice Thompson.
Chair Roblin, members of the House Rules Committee, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Department of Corrections. I'm here today to discuss the effects on House Bill 2930 on our department. House Bill 2930 requires the department to obtain residency information on the inmates in our custody. The department will need to determine two things. One, whether the inmate is a resident or a non-resident of Oregon. And secondly, if this inmate is a resident or a non-resident, whether the inmate is a resident or non-resident in Oregon, two, if the inmate resides in Oregon, what was their permanent address? This information will then be provided to the Legislative Assembly and the Secretary of State by January 1st, following the year of the decennial census. The Legislative Assembly and Secretary of State must consider the inmate's permanent address as provided by the department when appropriating the congressional and legislative districts. Concerns raised by this bill defines the permanent residence to mean a fixed place of abode or fixed domicile other than a department facility from which an inmate was transferred to custody of the department that the inmate considers to be the inmate's residence and to which the inmate intends to return following release from the custody of our department. Determining a permanent residence for an incarcerated individual that meets the above-mentioned criteria is very difficult. Few inmates are incarcerated from and return to the same address in the same cases, sometimes in the same county. For example, before coming to DOC custody, an inmate may be living in a rental property, in which case they can no longer claim that former residence as a viable option for their return. They may be living with a family at the time of the incarceration. Upon release, their family is no longer able or willing to support them. Many inmates are homeless at the time of their arrest and subsequent incarceration. Inmates are required to be released to the county in which they lived at the time their crime was committed. This may not be the county in which they were living at the time of their arrest or the county in which their crime was committed. In addition, inmates may request a waiver to be released to a completely different county. Because of these dynamics, the department begins to gather residence information with our inmates a few months prior to his or her release. 4 to 6 months prior to the inmate's release, the DOC counselor works with each inmate to develop a potential alternative living arrangements. The Board of Parole and post-prison supervision approves the county of residence for all offenders, and approval for the appropriate release address is made by the post-prison supervision authority. Although DOC works with the parole board and county corrections officers to establish the inmate's intended residence, its frequency not finalized until the final weeks or days prior to the release. DOC shares the determination of the release information with other public safety entities. In some cases, it's not determined at all. About 52% of our inmates who are released do not have permanent residences. They are placed in emergency housing, transition housing, or in some cases, they're homeless. In order to be able to report information on all inmates in the system on a 10-year cycle, the department would have to gather permanent residence information at our intake. This information would be self-reported, and gathering the resident's information early in the inmate's incarceration could significantly impact its accuracy. Section 2 requires the department to obtain the resident information upon forms prescribed by the department by rule. Gathering this information on form implies the manual process that would make producing this information at a 10-year interval difficult. The department's legacy inmate management system is not compatible with other electronic forms, so the electronic mechanism would be required the development of an independent system to record, store, and report residences' information, making the collection of this information in any usable format more difficult. The financial impact, in order to comply with these requirements of this bill, DOC would need to hire approximately 3 limited-duration correctional counselors for 1 year. These positions would determine the permanent residence information for approximately 13,725 of our inmates in our stock population. The DOC Aging Inmate Management System, as we call it, the CIS, would have to be modified to maintain the permanent residence information, or an independent system would be developed to capture the report and this information. We believe this effort could be done with our existing resources. In regards to the financial impact, Chair Roblin, we believe it would be significantly reduced if the definition of the permanent address was changed to the address at which the inmate was living at the time the crime was committed. That would coincide with the information that we collect now at intake when they're being processed, and that also assists with the releasing county when they're being transitioned out of our custody. Chair Roblin, that ends my testimony. Thank you for this opportunity. If there's any questions?
Any questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Gower. You were going exactly where I was scratching my head and wondering where you were going. Surely you have an address for these inmates, their last known address before they became addressed with you. And what you're suggesting at the end of your testimony is that if we use that address, it would be doable.
Chair Roblin and Representative Berger, that's correct. That's the information now that we're obtaining, and that helps, again, in reference to the time of release, working with the Board of Parole and Community Corrections.
Follow up?
Yes. So if that were the case, then the fiscal on this would be somewhat reasonable, whatever that means.
Chair Roblin and Representative Berger, yes, I believe the fiscal impact would be dramatically reduced.
Thank you.
Representative Berard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is your opinion of this bill?
Chair Roblin and Representative Gerard, we're neutral on this position.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Dennis.
Good afternoon, Janice Thompson with Democracy Forum, Oregon. We're supportive of the bill, kind of with an interest in fairness, as the Representative Shields mentioned, though maybe with a little bit different angle, which is it makes sense to us to count people where they can vote, which kind of conversely means maybe you don't count people where they can't vote, and right now they can't vote when they're incarcerated. But, you know, I really wanted to come after the folks from the DOC because I'm always aware that, you know, how you do these things can be really tricky. And so I wanted to be really clear that coming with a supportive interest, wanting to kind of learn, you know, help think through the administrative difficulties and whatnot. The best solution, unfortunately, is one that is not going to happen in time for the 2010 census, which is to have the census procedures be changed so that they're counting, like Representative Berger, where you're kind of pointing to and where you ended up in your testimony, which is count people, you know, where they resided before they were incarcerated. And there's been lots of work to try to have the census procedure changed. That's just not going to happen in time for 2010. You know, I don't even want to speculate about the politics and policy factors that are contributing to that not occurring. So I see 2930 is in lieu of that action, kind of in terms of the census procedures, what can be done here to kind of get that fairness. And so, you know, but again, recognizing the administrative angles to it, I mean, I would support the know, the shifts in terms of how you define that. I guess the other thing to think through and maybe get some feedback from somebody more familiar with exact census timeline is that January 2011, is that the date to zero in on? I think it probably is, but that could be something else to take a look at. Another possible amendment is to take a look at how this plays out at the local level, and carrying this concept down when cities and counties draw their district lines. And there are actually some examples in other states where it's kind of mind-boggling about if this is not done, how districts can be skewed. And there's one example in a relatively small town in Iowa where the city wards have about a 1,500, I think there are five wards and about 1,500 apiece. But there's a prison in one of the wards where none of the prisoners can vote, which literally means about 50 voters are represented by one city council member compared to 1,500. And something I haven't had a chance to do more research on, but folks on this committee could probably help with that, is looking at how that plays out, like in Salem and Pendleton, my sense is that that's not, those adjustments are not, have not been made in past city level census. So that's, I don't know if that's been a problem or not. But I just want to identify that if this is an approach, you know, that gets taken at the state level, there are definitely other states that allow local governments to make certain adjustments. And the other item I would just note is that in some cases the adjustment is not necessarily kind of counting folks in one spot as opposed to the other spot, but if they're not voting, to not count them in the redistricting process at all. So again, just in the interest of kind of tossing out some other options based on, you know, some level of digging into this, I just want to end, you know, with a support for the general concept. Not sure the bill as written is exactly how to pull it off, but happy to, you know, do more research and continue to help nudge the discussion along.
Any questions? Representative Edwards.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not really a question. It's a comment based on Ms. Thompson's testimony. As somebody whose district will be the recipient of a prison here soon, I'm thinking about this, and I hadn't even thought about at the local level how much, I mean, really how much difference that could make, say, in our county commission race where we have five county commissioners and then we're going to have X number of hundreds more voters concentrated in one area, and how, I mean, the effect would certainly be more profound, mm-hmm. and not just a shift from one area of the state to another, but actually people that never resided even in the county at all. And it even seems more obtuse to me anyway in that situation. So this is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Vote for me and get released.
They don't get to vote.
Not my slogan.
Are there questions for these witnesses? Thank you both.
Sure, Robin, thank
you. While they're incarcerated, they don't.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2930, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2846. And with that, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Rublin. Members of the committee, HB 2846 requires the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to make voter registration cards available to eligible voters at any office in which agent of the commission issue or renew licenses, tags, or permits. Requires agents of the commission to inform applicants for licenses, tags, or permits that the applicant may register to vote. Requires agents to ask whether the applicant is registered, and if not, whether applicant would like to register to vote. Directs commission to develop procedures under which persons who apply for a State Fish and Wildlife Commission license, tag, or permit can also register to vote on the same form. Requires each agent of the commission to deliver completed registration cards to county clerks where the agent is located. County clerk is directed to forward registration cards to the county of the applicant's residence. Under current law, ORS 247.012, a person may register to vote or update registration in either of two ways. One, by completing a voter registration card and mailing or delivering it to a county clerk or certain other designated officials. Or two, by completing the voter registration portion of the application for issuance or renewal of a driver's license or state identification card or a change of address at an office of the Department of Transportation. This bill would provide additional ways in which one could register to vote or update registration.
Thank you very much. And we'll just go down our list. The first person is Matt Bolstead. We'll also have Georgette Brown. Come on up.
Matt. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Matt Bolstad with PacWest, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Gun Owners Association. I would like to register our strong support for House Bill 2846. House Bill 2846 would add an important access point for Oregonians to register to vote, complementing the system currently used by the Department of Transportation at DMV locations. While we support access points through all state agencies, we understand that this is unrealistic given workload and financial constraints. But you have a unique opportunity before you to dramatically increase access to voting when you consider that there are 22 state fish and wildlife offices and 511 agents throughout the state, issuing hundreds of thousands of licenses, tags, and permits each year. Thus, House Bill 2846 would provide voter registration cards to a large segment of the population that is already filling out other applications. It should be noted that we do not wish to put a burden on the 511 private agents that issue licenses. House Bill 2846 leaves the Commission flexibility in developing this system. Simply having voter registration cards on hand and inquiring as to whether the person is registered to vote is not much of a time burden, especially compared to the paperwork that an applicant is already filling out for a license, tag, or permit. The only financial burden on the agent is that associated with the cost of mailing the voter registration cards to the county clerk. Perhaps a reimbursement option could be explored. House Bill 2846 is a significant yet easy step to increase access to voter registration in Oregon. We hope that it receives your support. Thank you.
Any questions?
I will, but I'll hold them until we've heard.
Till both of them.
Yeah.
Representative Nolan.
Just wanted to make sure I understood you. You're assuming that the burden for mailing these completed applications rests with the license agent, not with the prospective voter?
Well, that's the bill states that the agent shall deliver in a timely manner okay. registration cards to the county clerk.
Okay.
So they could deliver them by hand.
Yeah, they could, but they have to.
There is a requirement once they take possession of those that it has to get to the county clerk in a particular period of time.
It's 5 days.
And failure to do so has some fairly stiff penalties, I believe. So all of those agents would have to understand that portion. Okay. Okay. Any other questions at this time? Representative Jensen.
Do you have any numbers on the number of unregistered voters that there are that go to get hunting and fishing license?
Chair Roblin, Representative Jensen, I wish I could have those numbers. It's not a question that's really asked if someone's registered when they get a permit or a license. I tried to get the exact number, the average number of licenses, permits, and other documents that are issued by the Oregon State Department of Fish and Wildlife each year to kind of get an idea of how many people this would access or would have a question at least posed to them if they're registered to vote. But they didn't have those numbers at the time. I have to put in a formal request to get those from the department. So,
apologize, I don't have that.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, committee members, I'm again Georgette Brown, representing the Oregon Clerks Association. I just have a couple of small concerns about the bill. First of all, it states available at any office in which an agent of the commission issues or renews licenses. I'm from a small county, Josephine County. Our licenses are issued at the rear end of Bi-Mart, but where they sell the sporting equipment and stuff, and then at a USAVE gas station. They don't have a regular office. They don't have a way of really keeping things, like at the USAVE gas station, I don't know what the registrations would look like by the time they came to the county clerk's offices. But anyway, I just feel like it's a big burden on some of these small mom-and-pop places that where people get their fishing licenses and things. But again, that's not, I mean, it's no burden on the county clerk, but it's just that it just seems like these are places that are not official, like the DMV. And also it says, each agent of the commission shall deliver in a timely manner the completed registration card. Well, nowhere in the bill does it say within 5 days or anything. It just says in a timely manner. And I'm a little bit concerned with that, too, that, again, they'd have to get an envelope. Some of these places, like the gas station, would have to find an envelope appropriate or just drive the voter registrations to the clerk's office. So there would be a lot of education, I think, with some of these people that would be handling these voter registration cards. So I'm not completely against this, but I just have some concerns about those little mom and pop places having to do this extra work.
Okay. Questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some thoughts. I'm supportive of the concept. I have some concerns. As an angler and a hunter myself, I know that I usually procrastinate until the last minute to go get my license, and the line in the back of Bi-Mart is 20 people long. And I would be so irritated if the clerk was filling out voter registration forms as we're waiting in line. Distributing it is one thing. Getting the logistics of getting it filled out and getting it returned, I mean, I would hope that we could get to a place where we could get something worked out here, because I like the general direction that this is headed. But, if it holds the line in the back of Bi-Mart or Joe's or the local sporting goods store, you know, the day or two before opening season, and those lines get long, and I don't know. I have some concerns there. So
either one of you can answer.
Well, some of those are my concerns. I know people who get licenses and that kind of thing, and I'm in a small county, but there are very many small counties in Oregon where they have the same kind of facilities.
Yep. Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, as I mentioned earlier, the bill is somewhat flexible in allowing the commission to decide how the process would work exactly. So if it could be done that the burden's really on the person to fill out the card, and the only real responsibility of the agent is to ask, are you registered to vote? Here's a card. If you're not, drop it here. When you're done, then hopefully that wouldn't hold up the line too much. And if it is a primary concern that this does put an undue burden on these agents, a potential amendment would be to at least have this process at the 22 state offices of the Oregon State Department of Fish and Wildlife, and then that would be more similar to the DMV because those are also state workers. So,
okay. Any other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Kurt Melcher and Janice Thompson.
Good
Kurt, go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I provided some written comments here as well today on House Bill 2846. I appreciate the opportunity to be here before the Rules Committee, my first time before the Rules Committee, and I appreciate it. So House Bill 2846, as was discussed earlier, would place a number of requirements on our license agents, and I won't go into all the details. I think you've discussed those here in earlier comments. I did want to mention that our agency has a long history of using private vendors for our licensing services going back many, many years. We're currently using a point-of-sale license system, fully electronic and automated. We have, right now, of course, the number of vendors changes occasionally as we gain and lose a few, but right now we have 479 point-of-sale license vendors in the state. These range, as also previously discussed, these range from small sole proprietor type operations to big box retailers. And each of these typically might have a number of employees, perhaps even in the tens of employees that are actually responsible for issuing licenses through our point of sale system. We also have a very small number of vendors that still issue single day, daily licenses. Typically, they're charter boat operators or professional fishing guides that have a booklet of daily licenses, and they make those available to their clients literally on the boat. They can sell a license. It's a handwritten license. Our vendors, our license agents, produce 2 million documents annually. They service approximately 800,000 customers. I say approximately because some of these are repeat customers. They may have come in and bought a fishing license. They come in later in the year and buy a hunting license. They come in later and buy an elk tag. But nonetheless, 800,000 approximately customers that they service annually. And these agents receive a per-document fee to cover the time associated with serving our customers. The department has an agent fee built into the license fee schedule, and the agent does actually recover hopefully their costs associated with providing the service to our customers. If House Bill 2846 was adopted as it's currently written, the department staff would need to develop an application form. We would also need to develop procedures, probably through administrative rule with our commission, to describe the process. And more importantly, we would need to update all of our contracts. We have contracts with all the 470-odd license agents that reflects their responsibilities. We'd need to update each of those contracts to reflect the new requirements regarding voter registration. We would expect that license agents would spend some additional time with our customers in inquiring about whether an individual is registered and providing the forms and or handling those. And they would also, we would expect, incur some costs associated with the additional handling and postage of delivering these to county clerks. And lastly, I just wanted to mention, I think it was mentioned a little bit here by Representative Roblin, but this may also, and I'm no expert in elections law or voter registration, but it may expose our licensed agents to some liability regarding the delivery of these documents in a timely manner. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
And I guess the one question I have is that when we talk about these 400 and some places, it does represent a lot more people. And each of those people who would actually collect it would have to be trained in order to do it correctly, would be my assumption. So you're and that would, what you're talking about when it comes to the contract, all that would have to be worked out so that you could explain to these private companies and their employees who are actually doing the work, their responsibilities and stuff under the elections law.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, that's exactly right. And there are certainly many, particularly in the case of the big box retailers, they have numerous employees. You know, they're providing service 18 hours or 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. They have numerous employees that would be responsible for completing these would be in need of whatever training is required, and I believe the Secretary of State's office does have some training requirement for those folks.
Okay. Any other questions before we hear from Janice?
Janice Thompson, Doctors for Morgan. Kind of like the previous bill, very supportive of this concept, really wanted to hear the testimony of others to sort out the administrative and other concerns. And I was going to actually also identify training as an issue. The Secretary of State's office and in general Oregon, its work with DMV and other agencies that are at which voter registration cards are made available under the National Voting Registration Act. Oregon is, I think, very highly respected in, you know, how it implements those programs. And one key element of that is Secretary of State-provided training to those agencies. So that, I think, would need to be a piece of this. Fits with testimony from the commission. I mean, it's very appealing, the thought of, you know, having more folks out there and whatnot. So, again, supportive of the overall concept, would really identify the training needs and, you know, potentially making it, you know, permissive instead of a shall, maybe just zeroing in, you know, on just having it be an option made available at the offices as opposed to every vendor. But definitely, you know, like the idea of, you know, thinking about any and, you know, these kinds of licensing opportunities at this and other agencies.
Questions? Because I think you know this, Dennis, what's the liability if I choose not to turn them in?
I do not know that. I would defer to the Secretary of State. I have a pretty good guess, but I think they're here. I would let them answer.
Okay. We'll ask them to come up
Once
they're here. Any other questions? No. I would love to have someone from the Secretary of State's office come on up.
I have a question for them.
Because we have a number of people that have questions for you. Since you spend your time here, we like to make you feel a part of the group.
Thank you. I'm starting to feel really close to you all.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the Secretary of State Elections Division. And there is a violation for an agency not returning voter registration cards to either to our office or county elections office within 5 days. It's a civil penalty of $250 per card.
And if they were accidentally to drop, say, a certain group of cards because they didn't particularly like that was the way it was registered in another, I know you talk about this in your training, there's a penalty for that as well, I believe, or it's a true elections violation.
You must forward any voter registration card to a county elections official or the Secretary of State's office within 5 days.
Is there a penalty for that failure?
A $250 per card.
Okay, including the ones you didn't get there, if you didn't get them.
Well, it would have to be proven that
There
was a card to begin with.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, is there a prohibition against distribution, just the distribution of voter registration cards through, say, licensed agents or any other business? Is there anything in law that says you can't have a stack and hand them out?
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, there is no approval. Anyone can get voter registration cards, request them from our office, and have them available at a location for someone to pick up.
Oh, yep. The reason I ask is as we're out campaigning, I go down to the county elections office, and I get some of those cards, and I carry them with me, but they have me sign out for them. And they want reported back whether if I don't turn them all back in. So there's some, I assume there's some sort of loose tracking, and I didn't know if that was by a county law or ordinance or state law or
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, there is a statute that says that if someone were to request more than 500 voter registration cards, they have to go to the Secretary of State's office to get those cards.
Oh, he really is busy.
Follow up and clarification. So this is not the Secretary of State's office. This was a stack. They were pre-packaged in a group of, I think, 100. And I was asked to sign them out, and I did that. And so anyway, I guess my final comment is that I have a similar bill requiring different people, doesn't have anything to do with licensed agents, to distribute voter registration cards to their clients, and did not require that they collect them and take them back, because I do have a concern about folks that don't work for the state kind of culling the cards and saying, well, you know, I don't really like this person's party registration, and just kind of letting that fall in the trash. And as much as I would like to see particularly anglers and hunters registered in higher numbers as one, I have a concern about having that turned over, and so just for the record.
Any comments?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, the reason that we have the five-day turnaround is for the protection, of course, for the voter to make sure that their cards get in by the registration deadline days prior to an election, so that they can vote in any upcoming elections. And for, as you explained, for some reason someone may not like that particular party, may hold those cards so that the deadline is missed.
Any comments why he had to sign up for 100 as opposed to the rest of us that only had to do it if we had 500? No, I don't expect any answer to that one.
I'll ask Lane County Elections. I've got a long list of stuff to work out with Lane County Elections, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Seeing none. Thank you.
I would like to clarify. I believe the reason that they're having you up to 100 is because if you go over the 500, you have to come to the Secretary of State to get the remaining of the cards.
That'll be a way of tracking my aggregate.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a good cover. That was nice. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much. And I haven't asked this on the past, but if there's anyone who did not sign up that would love to testify to this bill, the seats are open at this time. Please. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Gary Rowell, and I'm a post-bac for the Political Science Department at Portland State. I'm down here as an intern for a particular lobby for which I'm not speaking on. I actually just did a paper on vote by mail, and on the vote by mail, what I did is I challenged a professor at Portland State about her stand against vote by mail. And what I did,
could we get your name one time?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
You did it. You did it.
Gary Rowell, Rowell.
Thank you.
And during my paper on vote by mail, I challenged a particular political science professor, in which I got to be real careful not to take her class, but I did challenge her on her stand on vote by mail, and I took out of that, Representative Jensen, the number of the seven lowest number counties of the difference between the registered voters and the children of the seven lowest counties, and that we only came up with 1,690 from the numbers of the estimated 2008 and the numbers of the 2007 estimated by the counties, and only out of the seven lowest, of which all were from Eastern Oregon, 1,690. And what I found out from the vice chair of the elections committee in Wallowa County is that for some reason there are people that feel that voting or registering by vote actually puts them into a group that will put them onto jury duty, which is not true, but that's what their feeling is. Now, if you're 1,690 Eastern Oregon people all, you know, hunt and fish, then at this point, this particular bill would be very general and perhaps even generate some additional ones. But only less than 1,700 people in the seven lowest counties is all that we have on the estimated numbers. And I just, only reason that I bring that forward is because that was the documents or the information that I received when I actually did the paper on the vote by mail.
Representative Johnson.
Am I understanding that this 1,000 plus told you or you had information that directly said that the reason we didn't vote was because, or didn't register to vote, is because of putting us on a jury list, or was this something that the clerk's office or someone in the county told you?
Chair Roblin and Representative Jensen, it was a comment that was made to me in terms of what was heard on a number of occasions. And so in terms of out of 1,700 people, all of them don't want to be on the jury, I can't answer.
Okay. I follow up.
Yep.
I don't know where it comes from, and I don't know that it's peculiar to Eastern Oregon, but there are people out there who think that registering to vote is a source of jury pool, So there are folks that don't register to vote because they don't want to serve on juries. And all I have to do is tell them they're over 70 years old and they don't have to worry about serving on juries. And as long as you don't look like Representative Gelcher, why, you can get away with that.
But I appreciate the opportunity to speak, only as I'm not prepared to do so. But I just thought that it was real interesting when Representative Jensen brought up the question in terms of how many unregistered voters. I figured I'd break that forward.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Jensen.
I think the reason that brought that particular question up is I believe you'd find that a large number of the large percentage of the hunters and fishermen in the state are registered voters.
I think
voters.
So, too.
I mean, there are several reasons that go with that, but I think as a group, and this is pure speculation on my part, but as a group, I think they're overrepresented at the polls of other groups of the same size.
That would be an interesting
survey. It'd be interesting.
Survey. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other questions from the committee? We're going to close our public hearing on 2846, and then a couple announcements. First, there will be no meeting on Wednesday, the 18th, but there will be a meeting on the Friday, the 20th. And anything else that we have? Is there any other business to come before the committee that anybody has? Then we will adjourn our rules meeting. Thank you very much.